If everyone could take their seats, we are going to call the ad hoc committee to review the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor committee to order. If Angela, if you could take roll, please. And Angela, if you're there, if you could take roll.
Chair DeBrava.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Perkins.
Here.
Regent Brooks.
Here.
Regent Carter.
Here.
Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Geddes. You do have a quorum.
Thank you. We will go into item one, public comment. Do we have any public comment in Elko?
There is no public comment in Elko at this time.
Thank you. Any public comment in Reno? Seeing no public
comment. Hello again. Kip Irvin, ERVIN, State President of the Nevada Faculty Alliance. We welcome a robust discussion of the roles and duties of the chancellor. Let's recognize that a discussion of the duties of the chancellor is also necessarily a discussion of the roles and duties of the board itself and of the presidents. At a very high level, do we want a chancellor who has a coordinating role with the presidents and who mainly oversees the technical administration at the system level? Or alternatively, do we want a chancellor who is the academic leader of higher education in Nevada with a major role in hiring and supervising presidents? Either model or a hybrid can work as long as everyone knows their roles and duties. At a more detailed level, this committee can identify and fix some structural issues in the rules of order and duties of the chancellor. For example, there needs to be a clear line of approval for agenda items and official communications with no possibility of a stalemate because the bylaws call for collaboration or consultation, which can be ambiguous. The purpose of rules of orders and bylaws is to allow an organization to make decisions through civil discourse, even when people strongly disagree, but to come to definite final decisions. I would note that more specific duties of the chancellor are embedded in other places in the handbook besides the bylaws, and those should be itemized and reviewed. One possible thing just to consider is whether it would be prudent to have the chief financial officer report directly to the board rather than to the chancellor. I'm recalling a situation from the early 1990s when the director of state benefits hid financial deficits from the oversight committee, and then the state had to bail out the public employees benefits program. So just consider the lines of authority as a prudence issue of prudence. I also want to emphasize that shared governance is essential for a healthy and well-functioning system of higher education. Shared governance is not just receiving input from faculty senates to tick off the box. It's the concept that faculty are intimately involved in developing policy, especially for curricular and program issues and academic standards, but also including personnel policies on the academic side. That means that the duties of the assistant chancellor and the board must recognize that those policies need to come from the bottom up with guidance from the top. Please take these suggestions as constructive in the constructive spirit that they are offered. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other public comment in Reno? Seeing none, any public comment?
No other public comment in Reno.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, we will go to item two, chair's report. Well, I just wanted to put today's meeting into context as we dive into this issue and examining the roles and responsibilities. Today's meeting, everything is informational only. There's no action items. I anticipate having another meeting in September, and a date that's floating around maybe is September 23rd. And on that meeting, we would also have informational items to explore, maybe comments that were made today's meeting or even new comments made at that September meeting. And then our goal would be to bring another meeting following the special meeting scheduled October 14th, I believe. And that meeting, we would want to have some action items if the board or this committee came up with suggestions or items. So we would maybe try to take some votes in that October meeting. So I just wanted to put that in perspective. And then anything that this committee decides would then go forward to the full board at the December meeting. Okay. We will go to item three, review committee charge and history of the chancellor position. Acting Chancellor Dale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Dale Urquiaga, acting chancellor, the Nevada System of Higher Education. I want to begin by applauding the board chair, Kathy McAdoo, for appointing this committee and for the board in supporting that action. I think this is a very transparent process, and we hear a lot about those two words in our line of business, as we should. And so I commend you for engaging in this work. The chair of the board expressed to the chair of this committee and to me when she made these appointments that it was her intent to complete this discussion, have the board vote on any changes that you may see fit in December, so that after the first of the year, the board can begin a search at your discretion for the next chancellor to fill this role. So my specific charge today is to review with you your charge. There is an attached document. I will not read it to you, but I will simply represent to you that the role of the chancellor is created within the region's handbook. It also exists in state law, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment, but your responsibilities over these next three meetings in recommending changes to your colleagues and the full board your responsibility is to review those roles as delineated, decide which you would keep, which you would amend, which you may delete, which you may move. So you have, I think, fairly broad latitude here as you discuss this role as one of your primary employees. And as the committee chair has said, we are floating around the date of September the 23rd and then October the 14th for you to continue your work. So if you didn't get the gist with me quoting Greek mythology in the earlier remarks, I am a person who appreciates history and appreciates narrative. When I was appointed to this job, one of the first things I did was go back into the history of the Board of Regents and to determine when the office of chancellor was created and why. And I believe in a couple of things in public policy. One is making decisions based on evidence, and the other is making decisions based on knowing what happened. We all arrive in these jobs. As you know, I have had many, and we think we are the brightest new thing, and we have this great new idea when, in fact, that may have been discussed 60 years ago. And so because none of you were on the Board of Regents when this job was created, I'll give you a quick history. In February of 1968, the Board of Regents accepted a report from its own study committee, comprised of faculty, actually, which they had appointed in 1967 to review the organization and administration of what was emerging as a system. You will remember from your history that we started with one university, and in the 1950s, we added a southern branch of that university. We added the Desert Research Institute around that same time, and in the mid-1960s, we added a community college, first in Elko County. And so by 1967, it was clear to the board that there was an emerging system here. The operating structure at that time, the constitutional office of president of the university, was the leader of those really four entities: the northern campus, the southern campus, the research institute, and the one college. That president of the university had two chancellors who worked, one in Reno and one in Las Vegas. So in 1967, chancellors ran the universities, and the president ran what was becoming a system. It was not yet called a system. So when the board adopted the report in 1968, they did a couple of things. They created the Nevada System of Higher Education, had a slightly different name. They created the Office of Chancellor, taking their current president, switching his title to chancellor, and then they renamed the institutional chancellors to be presidents, because that way we would all be confused forever as to which of those jobs was held by whom. And as you know, this title is used different ways across the country. But that was the decision of the board in 68. in 69, they went to the regular session of the legislature and they codified that. The means by which they did it, the legislature went in and amended the chapter by switching out the word president and inserting the word chancellor. They didn't do much more in terms of legislative direction at that time as to the duties of the president. However, the board had a very lengthy discussion in receiving its committee report about what the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor ought be. Sound familiar? There really is nothing new in higher education in our state. And their seminal point of conversation was, as the previous speaker in their public comment said, the tension between coordinating and executive. And they ultimately sided on the side of executive rather than a merely coordinating role, and that was largely in how the chancellor related to the two institutional presidents. And so they did the following things. As I've said, they changed the title from president to chancellor. They provided that the chancellor report to and be appointed by the Board of Regents to be the chief executive officer of the University of Nevada system, as it was called in those days. And they defined the responsibilities of the position as follows. One, coordination of the activities, policies, and programs of the two universities, wherever these overlap, conflict, or inefficiently compete. That's a direct quote. Number two, coordination of system financial support and planning. Number three, the Board of Regents' secretariat function. So a bit on that. In those days, the chancellor served in the role of secretary to the board, which we have retitled chief of staff and special counsel to the board. So if you look at the minutes in 1968, the chancellor respectfully submitted those minutes. That function changed later as the system grew. And then the final responsibility assigned in 1968 was the coordination of legislative relationships. Today, there are some 300 sections of the Board of Regents Handbook Policies and Procedures Manual that deal with the chancellor. It's actually, I think, 644 references, but it's about 300 items. The title or the role also appears in statute in a number of places, specifically 24 statutes. So there is the statute that creates the chancellor's office or the position of chancellor, and then there is a body of law in that same chapter about the chancellor's fiduciary responsibilities as the official treasurer, I think is the term of art. But then elsewhere, everything from appointments to the apprenticeship council, serving as a member of the Board of Trustees of the College Savings Plan of Nevada and the Economic Development Board, appointment of members to the English Mastery Council, and subpoena powers granted to the chancellor. So, as I say, there are about 24 statutory references, some 300 in our own handbooks, all which sort of contribute to what are the roles and responsibilities of this system head, or as we style it here, chancellor. And so as you begin to think about this work, you have the list that is provided in the next or the agenda item one after this that delineates what our handbook says the roles and responsibilities are. That list is slightly longer than the four that the Board of Regents started with in 1968, but you'll see some of those same things that appeared in 1968 appear on that long list. And then just know that there are a number of other places where duties are assigned to the office, which I temporarily hold. One last fun fact, because I love fun facts, and this one came to my desk on Monday, thanks to General Counsel Martinez. One of the duties of the chancellor is to sign contracts as delegated by the Board of Regents. And I saw a report on Monday that in fiscal year 22, the one just ended, the chancellor executed 402 contracts on behalf of the board. And I have joked with the staff that all I do is sign my name and go to meetings. And now I know that that is in fact true. That is more than one a day of executing contracts. And that does not include contracts less than $1 million, which are executed at the institution level by the presidents. So a great deal of this job is the business of the business. So, Mr. Chair, that is my brief history lesson and fun fact potpourri of the day. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We will be going to item number four, and we have a paper that everyone has in their packet. It's about 21, 22 pages. This is allotted 30 minutes. I would hope that the presenters would touch on the key takeaways and then be available for questions as we continue deliberations throughout the day. And I was going to refer to Acting Chancellor to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Regent Geddes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't get in there quick enough, but I'm just curious if Acting Chancellor Urquiagua has made any evaluations or recommendations yet, or if you just want to kind of go through the process. I mean, you've gone through the history. You've seen what's there. Granted, you've only been in the job a little while, but I don't know if you're ready to make those now or if you plan on making those later. But as somebody with your background and experience and coming in and looking at it, I'm just curious what your initial thoughts are.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through you to Regent Geddes. Regent Geddes, you've known me for many years. You know I have opinions about everything. And I am going to hold them to myself. I am, as I go, sort of making evaluations of this makes sense, that doesn't make sense, why do I do this, should the next person do that. And I will hold those until such time as I'm formally asked, and not so as not to prejudge your decision-making process. Maybe when we get further down the line, if you'd like to hear all of my opinions, I'll give you a concise summary of them. But until then, I'll bide my time, bite my tongue.
You, Acting Chancellor and Mr. Chair, and we will definitely want your opinion when we hit that point. I kind of want it now, but I appreciate your deferring to us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. Dale, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'll take us to item four. When the committee chair asked staff to prepare for this meeting, one of the things that we suggested, Executive Vice Chancellor Abba and I suggested, is that we turn to the national organizations WICHE and SHEO for some advice to give you context for what system heads look like across the country and what issues are in play in this, as I say, this sort of loose, tight tension in what this role is in coordinating and serving as an executive. And so we put a request in for some research, and I will tell you, while they were on summer vacations and in any number of other meetings, the two organizations rose to our aid at no cost and prepared the paper that you have in your packets. With us on the phone, I hope, God willing, if the technology works, is Dr. Demaree Michalau. I hope I got that name right. Doctor, your name may be the only one worse than mine on today's agenda. And she has been the principal author of the paper that you have, and she will walk you through, Chair, the highlights, as you say, and then would be happy to take questions from the members of the committee. So, Dr. Michalau, if you are there, take it away.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Acting Chancellor, and members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. For the record, my name is Demi Michalau. I'm the president of the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, or WICHE. And also for the record, I am joined by Dr. Patrick Lane, Vice President of Policy Analysis and Research. WICHE was formed in 1953 through the Western Regional Education Compact, and Nevada joined the compact in 1959. The Western governors formed WICHE in the spirit of regional collaboration and resource sharing, both of which remain our focus today. Our mission is to work collaboratively with our Western states, territories, and freely associated states to expand educational access and excellence for all residents of the West. And we do this by promoting innovation, cooperation, resource sharing, and sound public policy. WICHE serves a large geographic area that spans from the Dakotas to the Republic of Palau, and the region represents wide diversity in demographics, political leanings, economies, et cetera. I'd also like to introduce our partner organization in this work, the State Higher Education Executive Officers, or SHEO. SHEO is a national organization that serves the chief executives of statewide governing, policy, and coordinating boards of post-secondary education and their staffs. SHIELD's president, Dr. Rob Anderson, was also scheduled to be here today, but he sends his regrets because of a family emergency. Together, our organization submitted the report that is in your materials today. I would like to thank Chancellor Urquiaga and Executive Vice Chancellor Crystal Abba for answering technical questions and making themselves available as needed for this work. And I know my time is limited, so I plan to briefly walk you through the report at a high level and hopefully lay a solid foundation for the committee's work. Our goal was complementary to the committee's charge, and we're aiming to support the board as it explores the chancellor's role and roles and responsibilities within the system to determine whether changes in its management and leadership structure are necessary to better serve the state and its residents. It's not uncommon for WICHE to engage in this type of work in support of our states. And in this case, we did operate under a compressed timeline compared to most of our engagements, but we hope that despite that, it does provide you with the tools you need to thoughtfully meet your goals. And should the committee be interested in a deeper analysis that would be more typical of our governance and leadership work, we would be happy to help in whatever way is most useful to you. I'm going to start by walking through the general roles and responsibilities of a chancellor, not just in Nevada, but what we see in chancellors across the West in that role. And just to be clear, no two states have the same leadership structure, and nor is there one structure that's ideal. State context is a critical factor in determining what's most effective and appropriate, but we do see some patterns in this role. So chancellors in general have a wide variety of responsibilities, as you heard the acting chancellor describe. And in any context, they include a combination of both leading and managing between and among activities of a system. So for example, they must provide and sustain the strategic direction of the system. Working closely with their Board of Regents, the chancellor leads activities that sustain the system's strategic direction in serving the state's public agenda. Chancellors oversee institutional leadership. And while this looks different in different states, most chancellors are responsible for hiring and evaluating the institutional presidents. Chancellors facilitate system budget approval and implementation. A disorganized or chaotic process for making budget requests in which institutions independently approach the legislature or the governor can lead to frustrations and ultimately poorer outcomes for the system. They implement key system-level policies. The chancellor is generally responsible for administering academic, financial, and other policies of the system. They manage system-level management and collaboration where it makes sense, such as the back-office operations, and you heard a little bit about that earlier. Working with the system staff, a chancellor is expected to identify opportunities for efficient management and collaboration of things like HR, IT, and legal. They lead and represent the system's activities with state-level entities external to the system office. That could be the governor, legislature, or other agencies. And ensuring a coordinated effort with the legislature and governor without end runs will foster an environment in which both the state and the system can better achieve its public agenda. And it's also important for the chancellor to work effectively with other state agencies. Chancellors support institutional presidents in difficult decision-making and conflict resolution. Institutions within a system occasionally have conflicts. Sometimes those conflicts are internal, and sometimes they are with other institutions within the same system, and often the chancellor is in the best position to assist in these situations. And finally, I'll mention that chancellors engage in system-level fundraising. Now, in many systems, the institutional presidents take the lead in fundraising, but the chancellor can play an important role by representing the state's collective higher education enterprise to key businesses and industries, as well as major donors. So while these roles are drawn, you know, from what we're seeing in higher education in the West, the specific roles and responsibilities of the chancellor in Nevada are laid out, as you know, through a series of different instruments. That includes the state constitution, state statute, Board of Regents handbook, and the procedures and guidelines manual. Additionally, the contract between the regents and the chancellor, as well as everyday practice, have significant influence on the overall leadership of the system. So in general, the Board of Regents, as you know, sets NSHE policy, approves budgets for the public system of higher education, and hires and evaluates the chancellor. This is similar to other boards of regents throughout the region, but a unique feature of Nevada's system is the elected nature of the board. The Nevada Board of Regents is the only statewide elected board in the West that governs the state's entire public higher education system. And like appointed boards, this structure allows for complementary skills, backgrounds, and perspectives to be brought to the relationship between the chancellor and the board. But what is brought to the table is different. Chancellors in Nevada are typically selected for their deep knowledge about Nevada's context, their experience in administration, and their ability to be a servant leader. Complementary to that, the regents bring an important external perspective, and perhaps most important, they have been chosen by their constituents to represent their district on matters pertinent to Nevada's higher education system. And the combination of this expertise and knowledge contributes to a highly functioning statewide higher education system and emphasizes the different perspectives that complement the important technical background of agency staff. The Board of Regents handbook outlines in detail the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor in Nevada, and due to time constraints, I will not review them all here. But it's important to point out that recognizing the unique characteristics of an elected board, the chancellor has a major responsibility in supporting each board member as well as the decisions of the Board of Regents. And like in other systems, he or she also supports the institutional presidents in difficult decision-making and conflict resolution. Finally, in addition to those responsibilities laid out in the handbook, Nevada statute also prescribes obligations of the chancellor, which include participation on various state boards and councils related to post-secondary education, state data systems, workforce development, and economic development, as well as making appointments. And I highlight these because they are important functions that serve the system, but perhaps are overshadowed by some of the other responsibilities. And finally, while not in handbook nor in statute, the chancellor is sometimes a member of the governor's cabinet. And when we counsel states and systems that are considering leadership structure changes and the like, we strongly urge states to be deliberate and ensure that any changes to statutes, operating policies, or practices are well thought out so that they will lead to desired outcomes. And by forming this committee and holding these meetings, the board is doing exactly this. You're asking the right questions and carefully considering the impact of the decisions made by the board on students, the institutions, and others. Richie is not in the business of telling a state what to do, but we are here to share our observations from across the region and support the board in Nevada's system of higher education as you make these decisions. And we felt that the best way to support the committee at this stage was to develop a set of questions that we hope can guide your work. You may have additional questions or want to tackle one or more in a different way, but we think that these provide at least a useful place to start. And I won't read them to you as they're in the report, but I'll explain our rationale for the questions that we presented. And that rationale is twofold. First, we encourage you to begin by clearly articulating your vision so that you're all rowing in the same direction or at least rowing in the same pond. When you do that, it's important to connect the leadership system and its roles and responsibilities to effectiveness. And for example, that could be, articulating how changes to the leadership system will benefit students and help NSHE drive the state's economy forward or improve system efficiency. Second, we want to provide a way to help you think through the benefits and risks of the decisions you're considering. To supplement this, and ideally after your vision is articulated, we've also provided a tool, and you'll find that in Appendix B, and it's designed to help the committee systematically work through the key current responsibilities of the chancellor and consider the impact of the changes to those roles. We think that walking through the specifics of how changes to roles and responsibilities might be shifted and to whom, as well as what statutory policy or practice changes would be necessary, would be a worthwhile exercise. And subsequent work would likely include a more detailed analysis, and Richie and Chio are happy to assist with that if it's helpful, but that should ideally be done after the committee has a more fully formed idea of the direction it wants to go. And a point I want to leave you with is that it doesn't always take big change to get the results that you want. As a board, you have levers that you can pull that are already in place to shore up the relationship between the board and the chancellor that may be consistent with your vision. It may be that you need to spend some time researching those options as well. For instance, while perhaps not always explicitly emphasized, the chancellor has a responsibility in supporting each board member as well as the collective decision-making of the Board of Regents. And we would be remiss if we did not share some cautionary tales of leadership structure change that we've observed. One pattern we see is that when a state makes significant changes to its leadership structure, it typically results in 3 to 5 years of little to no progress on board priorities, because the focus inevitably shifts to establishing new policies, processes, and practices, as well as socializing the reforms with the campus's legislature, governor, and the public. In addition, shifts in roles and responsibilities almost inevitably have downstream effects that can have negative impacts if not carefully considered and planned. Changing the necessary policies downstream also takes time, especially when statute and policy must be changed. Finally, and this most often gets overlooked, changes in leadership structure have effects on the agency staff. So for instance, if the staff have expertise and institutional knowledge that the board relies on, it's important to understand what the impact will be on them. We have seen high turnover in state agencies due to leadership structure and governance shifts. And in one state in the region, that high turnover has become the norm. In closing, we recommend that the committee first work to articulate the vision for system governance and its relationship with the chancellor. And if you can think about what ideally this would look like, that vision will guide your process for deciding what changes, if any, need to be made. And exploring how to accomplish your goals using the tools within your current structure and framework is a worthwhile endeavor. Because changes can often take years to implement, we think that any change should be approached with a laser focus on the benefits those changes will bring for students, improvements in system efficiency, and meeting state workforce needs. If you can't tie the change or changes to those, then the risks associated with the change is greater. And we strongly encourage you to carefully think through the downstream impacts of the decisions of the board, and we hope that that tool in the report will help you do that. Finally, Wichi and Shio are here to support the committee, the Board of Regents, and ENSHI in whatever way we can be useful to you. I thank you for your time and attention, and we are happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Mikkelu, for your presentation, and thank you to Wichi and Shio for providing our reference material here in the paper that was presented. It is very helpful. Any questions specifically for our presenter? Regent Carter.
So this isn't quite in the report, but I'll ask and see if you have any thoughts on it. But currently, I think in our structure, we give the chancellor the ability to essentially come up with an organizational structure for the system level. Do most systems allow that, or does the board kind of set those priorities or areas for the structure of what that system looks like?
Mr. Chairman, Regent Carter, I couldn't say if it's most. It's a mix. We do have states that the legislature actually has a role in that. We have at least one state that does it that way. The legislature has to approve each FTE, and it's quite tied to that. But we do have structures that are more like Nevada's, where there is flexibility for the executive to do that. And it's probably, and Pat can help me with this, but I think that it would probably be more like this, that, you know, with the authority to set that structure than the other way, but we could come back with a definite number, at least in the West, if that would be helpful.
I'll defer to the chair whether you'd want that information or not.
Yeah, please. I then am going to go to Regent Geddes.
Actually, Regent Carter asked my question, so I'm good.
Okay. Regent Del Carlo, we'll let it go.
Thank you, Regent Dubrava. I just was wondering, our state is unique, and we hear that all the time because we're an elected board. And so all these other states, when the governor appoints the people or the legislature, however it's done in these states, is there criteria for how these appointments are made? I mean, we go to our voters in Nevada, and it's enshrined in our Constitution back to 1864. But when it's appointed, do they have to meet minimum qualifications? Are they just a political appointments? Is it all over the board? Because you try to find a balance on a board. People have a strong financial background, people that have a business background, people that have maybe HR, et cetera. So I'm just wondering, because our voters, in our constitution, we do not have any qualifications to be a regent other than two, which is to be of voting age and to live in our district. So my question is just on the qualifications that other states use to determine their trustees or regents. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Regent Del Carlo, it's really all over the board with that. Most often you see geographic requirements so that the regent would have to represent a certain area of the state. And they're usually staggered terms. So the governors, if you have a state where the political party switches, you'll often have a mix with those backgrounds as well, because that's intentionally done that way. And the state context is really important here. So there is a mix. I have not seen a situation where you have to have like a minimum degree, or you have to have a post-secondary education degree. I've not seen anything of that sort. The qualifications more are around geography, I'm going to pause there. An example would be in Colorado. They don't have a requirement, I don't believe, but they do try, even governors of a certain political party will try to mix up their appointments. And I don't think that's a requirement, but there is some tendency to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we appreciate your attendance at our meeting. And if you're
Mr. Chair,
yes,
sorry,
Regent Geddes.
Yeah, just another question popped up, and I don't know how it. Not sure where it fits in, but we have the open meeting law requirements, and they're very stringent. So when we do presidential evaluations, they're every 3 years, and they're very public, and they're very out there. But our annual evaluations are done by the chancellor on the 8 system presidents. And I'm just kind of curious in other states how that process works and how that information gets out there, because we generally only see it every 3 to 4 years when it's the public evaluation. And the public evaluations, in my opinion, aren't great because it's so public. And we used to be able to do them privately to a point, but now we can't. So I'm just curious how other states, specifically chancellors or presidents with presidents and chancellors, how they handle that annual evaluation and how that leads into the full evaluation, or if that's even a requirement elsewhere.
Mr. Chairman, Regent Geddes, I don't know how, if you can measure which state has the most open meeting, or the most stringent open meeting laws, but my sense in the West is that Nevada's is among the most stringent on the open meeting laws. I have not done an inventory of how all the states conduct that with that question in mind. But my understanding, if I am thinking through the states and how they are run, those are mostly, not confidential, but done in private and not done in a public setting. And when the boards are hiring people, even that varies quite a bit in how public that becomes. And, some systems will put forth a finalist and that's it. And then other systems are required to announce 5 finalists. So that varies as well. But my understanding, without having done the exact analysis, is that those presidential evaluations are largely done in private, in large part because they're a personnel matter and an HR matter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair DeBrava?
Yes.
Regent Arescato, one more question.
Please.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Michio, last question. In the main body of your presentation, you mentioned that there's an approximately 3 to 5 year lux of ability to get things done, lack of a better term, by the newly appointed officers if they're appointed, because it takes 3 to 5 years to get up and running. Was that an accurate statement on my part?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I could not hear who answered or who asked the question, but that is an accurate statement.
Thank you. Does that answer your question, Regent Arizcata?
Very much so. Short and concise. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We will now go to item 5, and we have NSHE constituency input. And at our future meeting in September, we will maybe have constituency input outside of NSHE, stakeholder groups in the community come forward. But we wanted to list our NSHE constituencies. And my fault, I left off classified staff. But we wanted to get input from our institution presidents. This is a good time to volunteer. If you say, hey, here's your interaction with the chancellor role, and can we make potential changes, or you think things are okay, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but we'd like to hear from you. And I leave it open to anyone that wants to step forward. I'm not going to call on each president, but we would like to hear what you think. Do I have anyone here in Las Vegas that wanted to comment? How about in Reno? Any of our presidents want to comment about us looking at the roles and responsibilities of chancellor? Okay.
Mr.
I'm going
Chair,
to go to, who do I have?
Regent Perkins here. I'm going to put some presidents on the spot because they're not from our system. If Dr. Whitfield and Dr. Pollard, since I know Dr. Pollard, you worked with similar to a chancellor, so I'd like to hear this perspective from someone outside the system looking in.
Dr. Pollard, would you like to?
I'd hoped that sitting on the end would prevent me from having to make any comments during this session, but thank you, Regent Perkins, for the invitation, and Darian Pollard for the record. I listened to the presentation quite thoughtfully and have enjoyed the reflection and the conversation, as you will attest to or commented on. I've worked in a few other states besides Nevada. I've worked in California, where I was a campus president. I've worked in Illinois, where I started as a faculty member and left as a vice president. I've worked in Maryland, where I was a president and worked directly for a board. So I have a unique perspective on this that is probably maybe too informed in the perspective of that. What I would offer in this is that for me, and I thought one of the comments that was made earlier is important. There are two things that I think have to be thoughtfully discussed and agreed upon. One, I think there has to be a clear understanding of what is the role of the board and what is the role of the board CEO. And that is more than just, in my opinion, the series of responsibilities as elucidated in any various government governance documents. But what's the shared ethos about what the board believes its role is, and then as a result of that, what roles do they delegate to their CEO, and the way in which they then build the continuous relationship to ensure that the work is being done in the way in which they want to do that. That is a very deliberate act of governance that is oftentimes not explored as deeply as it should, and it takes time to do that. I worked for a board for 10 years, and we developed a stride based on a deliberate educational agenda, a deliberate philosophical agenda that took time and trust to develop. So I would offer that as a first observation. And then my second observation in this conversation about the relationship, that there has to be then, I think, within the system itself then, once there's a clear understanding of what the governance role is of the board and that of the chancellor, what that looks like in terms of how it manifests itself both within a system structure, in my opinion, and then the relationship between the board and the chancellor and the presidents. There's an oddness to me about the model that we have here. There's a dual kind of reporting line that strikes me as one I haven't seen before. So there has both strengths and weaknesses. I feel at any given point I could call a regent and have a conversation with you. And if our time and schedule aligns, that happens well. But there is an interesting nuance to that as well in terms of direction, as in terms of evaluation. And there's a different type of relationship then that is cultivated. So those are just my thoughts I have, and I'll pause now because that's more than I meant to say. Thank you.
And Regent Perkins, did you want to hear from President Whitfield? Please, sir.
You almost gave me an out there, Chair DeBrava, but I guess it didn't work. I always hate following my colleague because she always has these wonderful, intelligent insights and wonderful experiences. So I have some varied experiences as well, some of them more proximal than others. One system that I worked in was the Penn State system, which is an extremely large system. And then my most recent administrative position ended up having a board that directly communicated with the president. So I have that varied experience as well. I'd like to comment on where I see the condition and state of our relationship and the way that our board is actually structured and how the chancellor ends up working and working with the presidents. I actually like that dual reporting or dual communication lines that can be done where I don't have to file everything through the chancellor if I want to have a conversation with the regent, because each one of the regents brings a different flavor, thought, perspective on lots of topics. It's very, very useful to be able to have those independent conversations with them. The other piece is that open and constructive and frequent communication with the chancellor, I think, is something that almost needs to be written and codified, that's what's expected. I don't know whether to put it in as an element in an evaluation process, but it needs to be something that is expected of presidents with that relationship with the chancellor. I think then it goes one step further, and then that, Regent Boylan was bringing up the point about the open meetings law and some of our challenges with that. I wish we had an opportunity for our board and our chancellor to be able to have some additional conversations outside of the public realm, just so that if there's other educational pieces or other information that's needed for board members to feel as well prepared as they can be for meetings, that would be possible. But I'm not sure that that's kosher. I'm not trying to go against state law, but it's just one of those things that in observing previous operations of boards, all those boards have conversations before and after meetings, and it allows for a coordination and clear communication. And so I think I had three pieces there. But I would just come back to the point again that I think the communication lines where presidents communicate frequently and well with the chancellor, as well as being able to, as a president, communicate with board members is critically important for a functional system. Thank you.
Very well put. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, President Whitfield. Regent Del Carlo, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair DeBrava. I have a question of you, President Whitfield. I know we do have a very tough open meeting law, so just explain how those boards, they were able to meet. I mean, they meet formally or not, like very informally, a bunch of them would meet and then meet afterwards. I mean, we can't do a circular, what do they call that, a circular quorum, and we have to be careful what we say before a meeting, and, you know, it takes, seven of us, though. I mean, seven's a lot of people to get together to meet, which would be a quorum. So I'm not, maybe your boards weren't quite as big, so people were able to just talk offline. Could you just explain that a little bit more?
Well, in previous iteration, they were approximately the same size. You know, one of my experiences at a private institution where board membership comes through different ways, let's just put it that way. And then at Penn State, which I can't remember exactly how they are currently assigned, but there wasn't a restriction of communication among board members outside of the boardroom. And so that's the basic premise around the open meetings law, of that, you know, if you and Regent Carter wanted to talk about ways that we can increase graduate student funding, and then you brought in Regent Brooks, and you all could talk and come to a conclusion, come to a suggestion that was then brought up as a formal matter for discussion at the board meeting. Okay. And so it's those informal conversations that I know our current system does not allow that to happen. And there's real functionality to that. It really does advance the board and the board's perspective on extremely difficult conversations. Actually, come back to the one because I do appreciate Regent Brooks's champion of the graduate student piece. That is not simple at all. And one of the other pieces of a lot of those conversations is about being able to bring in either outside consultants like our Witchy colleague or even being able to have discussions of best practices. Sometimes in the course of a board meeting when we have eight different institutions, if we tried to have that level of just conversation, we would never complete our meeting. And so in those, I think that it really was pushed for a matter of efficiency. It wasn't as a matter of trying to hide things or, you know, getting one part of the board against the other part of the board. It was really for board communication. I'm going to take one step further out into this realm and say one of the other things that you see in behaviors of boards, particularly in relationship to the leaders, be a chancellor or a president, is that the board chair is actually able to talk to members and then use that information to coordinate with the chancellor or with the president about what may happen, things that will come up. That's then done as a group, and the board gets – I don't want to make a value statement, but I think that it really does help to empower the board more to be able to come to conclusions, even if there's differences of opinion. Mm-hmm. Those differences of opinion are known in advance, and that can be included in the discussion that are made public.
Thank you.
Thank you, President Whitfield. President Pollard, did you have a final
I just wanted
comment?
To add, I thought Regent DelCarlo's comment, Adrian Pollard, for the record, was a very important one, because I think, at least in my understanding, the main differences are oftentimes with the public meeting law in various states. So in various states, there may be different leniencies that are provided that are not provided in the state of Nevada. So, for instance, in the state of Maryland, there are 14 or 15 different exemptions by which the board could very well have a set of conversations that were not made in public, typically around issues of personnel, negotiation, there's a list of them, and you declare those up front, and you were able to have the types of conversations that I don't necessarily believe the Nevada open meetings law allows for. So I think those are oftentimes some of the nuances that are systems of which you have to respond to that you don't have the ability to make any changes to, but you have to be thoughtful of them. So great question.
Thank you. We could beg for leniency from the state, maybe. I'm going to go to Reno. I have President Hilgerson and then President Delpy. President Hilgerson, please.
Thank you, President Karen Hilgerson, for the record. First of all, I think this is a fascinating conversation, and I, too, have worked with several boards and in New York State, which hard to believe, but much more lenient when it comes to allowing board members to conduct informal conversations, including closed-door retreats that you could not conduct college business in those retreats, but you could build trust and build relationships. I'll start by saying I don't think there is a structural issue at NSHE. I like the roles and responsibilities for the chancellor as they currently exist. I, too, appreciate the dual reporting structure so that I can have access to board members. I do think, though, that a greater problem is when the relationship between the board and the chancellor, or between and among board members And I think part of this is because of open meeting law and the severe restrictions that I see compared to any other state I've worked. I do think it makes it difficult to do a couple of things, one of which was mentioned by the Wichi president, and that is for the chancellor to help colleges, and in this case, colleges and universities, work through conflict. Luckily, I think as presidents, we all work very well together, but we do have conflicts that are beginning to emerge. I think they're emerging more than I've seen in my, now I'm in my seventh year here at NSHE, and I think it's because, as we heard earlier today, the funding formula doesn't really work in the down times, right? That now we're looking at our base being eroded. So conflict is beginning as every institution is competing for enrollments. I noticed that I wish I could pronounce the name correctly of the Wichi president. I apologize because you seem extremely intelligent. I can't wait to meet you. But this idea that when we're competing for resources, conflict can ensue, and the chancellor can really assist colleges and universities in moderating those conflicts. And I think that's true, but I think what I've seen happen, and I've seen it happen as the funding has diminished, I don't understand anymore how the missions should be distinct or should differ among us. I think that I would encourage this board and the acting chancellor to really hone in on mission differentiation, which I think is cyclical among NSHE, and maybe those who have been here for many years can speak to that, that I think there have been times in the history of NSHE where the mission has been very, very clear among, so the differences between a two-year, predominantly two-year college, a state college, and the universities, and the subtleties regarding those differences. So, and I think the most obvious example, you really can't expect a two-year college to engage in research at the level that graduate colleges can engage in research. It's just not really our focus. And so I think mission differentiation is key, especially as the formula funding affects the way we go about enrollments. I will also say it was refreshing when Regent Geddes brought up the question related to presidential periodic reviews. I was not aware when I accepted this position almost 7 years ago that that's how they would look. I may have thought twice about that. I think that's a big, big issue. I'm also surprised and that we're pleasantly surprised that we're having this conversation, and I hope that one of the board members at a near future meeting asks for a new business item, and let's change this open meeting law. Let's work with legislators. Let's make it a priority, because I think until that is really resolved, the system is somewhat working with hands tied behind their backs, and that's really unfortunate. Thank you.
Thank you, President Hilgerson. President Delpy.
Hi, good afternoon. Kyle Delpy, President of Western Nevada College. I want to thank the group, the committee today, for including us in this discussion and for pulling us along when we all remained silent at the beginning there. I would ask that we can continue to be part of the discussion as we move forward, as are our shared governance partners that are also listed in Agenda Item 5. I've actually worked for four different systems, but I've been in this system for 20 years, so it's become a little bit of a history project to think back. A lot of what has been said by my colleagues, I agree with. I will hit a couple quick points here. The structure itself, I like having the structure of having a boss or somebody that I can go to talk things through, especially when as a president we're pulled between internal, external constituencies, and trying to weigh that and see where we are, where we might come down on a decision. I also like the ability to approach the board members, because many of you that are in the urban areas may not be as intimate with the details of a rural community college mission, nor do we expect you to, and that's our job to help explain that. So I won't, because you are an elected board and have your own regions, and service areas. You do represent the entire higher ed system, which does include the rural. So I'm happy to continue to meet and provide that information in an informal discussion, as we have been doing over the years. So the structure, I think, of having the chancellor and what that means, I know we'll get into an additional and deeper in other meetings, but I think that is actually functioning as a structure that can keep the system together. Other states use a similar structure to us, and then that informal discussion that we can have with the board members is valuable. Thank you.
Thank you. President Helens.
Yes, I'm right here in Reno. Well, I've been in six states as a president for over 30 years now. I've worked in the state system, separate system, combined systems, individual boards, system boards, both elected and appointed, union and non-union. And I think what matters, no matter what those structures are, for me is the word effectiveness. Not strengths, not weaknesses, effectiveness. And I know some of the board members know that word from me, because effectiveness can be measured. And so when we ask ourselves, what structure will be most effective for us in Nevada, we can define that and then we can measure that. What protocols are most effective for us to carry out what we say is necessary, that can be measured. And I really think that at any given time, whether it's a chancellor or a president, it's based on, I'd say, the current issues in that community or in the state. So it's a matter of fit. So it's not always the same kind of president. It's not always the same kind of chancellor. And that's up to the board to say, to define that, and then we can measure that. Regarding evaluations, I think that, and I followed Malcolm Baldrige Quality Initiative for decades now, which is used in business as well as in education. It's ongoing. So it's never a gotcha. It's never once a year. It's really an ongoing process of self-evaluation as well as evaluation by a chancellor or a president and our constituents. 360-degree evaluations in terms of that feedback that comes to a chancellor or a president. But I do think we need to look at a publicness of it in Nevada, which I have never seen before, other than coming here and experiencing it, to ask ourselves what really is the most effective way to do this and ask ourselves what is the outcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. President Zaragoza.
So I'm getting pulled into the conversation. Joyce, Federico Zaragoza, for the record. Joyce mentioned several themes that I also have kind of experienced in three states, actually. In one of those states, Wisconsin has a two-tiered system, obviously, one for the university and one for the community colleges. And it's an appointed process. The bottom line, and I think the WISH report captured that, is that there isn't a perfect system. At the end of the day, I think you do come to a realization that you've got to kind of create a functional and well-defined relationship, and that's going to vary through all of the dynamics that we've heard. But I do think, and I think these are some of the areas in terms of some of the experiences I had in Texas, that there is an opportunity here, I think, at the NCHE level to speak about the vision. You know, and Texas, that was a very trenchant part of what the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board did, is they defined at the state level what that state wanted to do. And that included things like, you know, how many degrees were going to be earned annually, what percent of the populace was going to go on to college, what were these aspirational goals that were important for the system as a whole. That conversation, I really haven't heard. And then the storytelling to be able to help with the marketing to support the colleges throughout Texas. So also finding out how you can invest really to support the kind of structures that you have. So those were two kind of areas that I think, and I just follow some of the comments that were made. In terms of the evaluation cycle, I think in Texas, and I've seen them done differently. But one of the areas that I would encourage that we look at is, I know here, it's the chair that does the annual evaluation of the chancellor. In Texas, in San Antonio, particularly at Alamo, it was the executive committee. And I think that that created, I think, a more organic process and didn't isolate two individuals kind of to do an evaluation, which kind of could create communication issues. But again, overall, I also kind of welcome the opportunity to have input into these processes. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. With the presidents, we appreciate you, of course, and if you have further input, please jump in. I was going to maybe just call on faculty senate chairs or the chair of the council of faculty senate chairs. I didn't know if they wanted to say anything. And then after that, I will call on Regent Boylan and Regent Geddes on my list. Please. Yes, chair of chairs.
Here. Tracy Sherman for the record, chair of the faculty senate chairs. At this point, we are going to withhold our comments. We are considering. Thank you.
Thank you, though. Regent Boylan.
Thanks, Chair DeRava. I just had a question, a suggestion, as well as to say, I appreciate what President Hilgerson said. I like the aspect of action. Let's go to the legislature and try and get some of this changed. If we just sit on our thumbs and say, well, they've done it, there's nothing we can do, well, then there's going to be nothing we can do. So I like the idea of us going to them. Now, I do think the idea of retreats where the open meeting laws doesn't really affect us so much, a retreat with the concerned parties and especially the board that we could discuss, or we won't deliberate. I know that there's a big difference in that term. Legally, you can discuss things, but you can't deliberate. So we could discuss things that would help us to help NSHE and help the students. So, and I thank all the presidents that have given some very succinct and great points. But I do like what President Hilgerson said. Let's go to the legislature and maybe get Mr. Kiaga, who has so much experience with the legislature and governing in Nevada, that we can make some changes. Thank you, sir. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. Regent Geddes.
Mr. Chair, mine is actually for the next agenda item, so I will hold.
Okay.
But there is public comment from the faculty senate chair from UNR here.
Okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, and apologies for the lack of communication. Been a busy week. Chair DeBrava and Regents, for the record, my name is Eric Marchand, M-A-R-C-H-A-N-D. I teach and conduct research in the College of Engineering at the University of Nevada, Reno, and I'm chair of the Faculty Senate here. Thank you for the opportunity to offer perspective and insight. As Kent Irvin mentioned earlier, shared governance is a key component of higher education, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide input on this important matter. As Faculty Senate Chair for the university, I respectfully recommend that any changes or modifications to the position's role and responsibility be measured and metrics-oriented. If there are any specific existing deficits in the current roles and responsibilities of the chancellor, these should be the primary focus for changes. NSHE has undergone significant changes in leadership during extremely challenging times, and the next chancellor will need to hit the ground running within an environment that does not add additional stress associated with navigating new structures and requirements in the system. Any changes should be forward-looking, strategic, and well thought out, as I'm sure they will be. As outlined in the WikiGEO paper, the elected nature of our current Board of Regents structure is unique among Western systems of higher education. I respect the input that the citizens of Nevada have in selecting our board. As such, the changes in board membership and leadership styles can lead to shifts in board personality, if you will, and this can lead to challenges for a chancellor to effectively manage higher education in the state. With this in mind, care should be taken with instituting significant changes in leadership roles. As the chief executive of higher education in Nevada, the chancellor should have the flexibility to lead in a nimble manner while being accountable to and obtaining counsel from the Board of Regents. I humbly recommend that decision-making processes for change to the current structures be student-focused and institution-focused with key outcomes in mind. Change for the sake of change is not a model for strategic improvement. If change is required to improve efficiency and effectiveness of higher education in Nevada, let's do so with a clear plan that is purpose-driven. I thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective, and I look forward to the work of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to reach out to the Nevada Student Alliance. Do we have, is it Dion Stanfill?
Yep, I'm here. So my name is Dion Stanfill, for the record. I am the ASUN president and also the chair of NSA. And first of all, I just wanted to say thank you for including students in this conversation. Chancellor Urquiaga reached out to me after attending the Nevada Student Alliance meeting a couple weeks ago and personally asked for our input to be at this meeting on this subject. And in my opinion, that's exactly how it should work. So thank you for that. So just quickly, a more so of a structure or less so of a structural change, more just a behavioral one. A role and expectation that we have for the chancellor is to be the liaison between students and the system. Just aiding in facilitating students to the system and students to the regent communication is huge. And this can be accomplished through attending student government meetings, the Nevada Student Alliance meetings, on occasion, and overall just willingness to be a part of the conversation with students.
Thank you. Do we have anyone from the classified council, from the executive board? Okay. I'm going to go to item number six, roles and responsibilities of the chancellor. And just a little housekeeping. There's a working lunch. We do have some lunch here in the back room. At 12:25, I have to excuse myself for a personal matter, and I'm going to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Perkins at that time. But during item six, I think this is the opportunity for the regents on the committee and those that are also in attendance to share their comments or some ideas if they want us to, you know, drill down later at the next meeting on some of those. And I think with the assistance with our acting chancellor, we'll take comments from the regents and kind of place them in different buckets, if you would imagine that, just to say, oh, this is regarding how the chancellor would work with our university and college presidents. This is how the chancellor would work with the budget or the legislature or the governor. Or this is how our chancellor would work with the regents in that relationship. So we'll kind of listen to what you say and then kind of put it in some buckets and bring that back at the next meeting. So with that being said, I see Regent Geddes' hand up there. Regent Geddes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to throw out my impression and all my time on the board was we have three primary responsibilities. One is hiring and unfortunately firing and assessing the presidents and the chancellor and our chief of staff. So there's really 10 people that report to us, and I expect all 10 of them to report to the full board. And I think that roles and responsibilities isn't clearly delineated in our handbook, and I'd like to make sure that we had that clear, that the A presidents and the chancellor and our chief of staff report to us. You know, the second one is our second major priority is budget. And, you know, we did the capital improvement back in April, and we just did the budget earlier today. And that's our secondary responsibility. And then the third is policy to implement the other two, basically. looking at the roles and responsibilities of the chancellor, you know, acting chancellor Urquiaga has only committed through December of next year. So we're going to have to start a search next spring. And we need to make sure that these roles and responsibilities are clear, because I don't think they have been clear for a while, clearly. That's kind of how we got ourselves into where we are right now. And we've got 8 presidents who are about to be evaluated in the spring of 23 during a legislative session. So I think making it clear that on the day-to-day, the chancellor works with the presidents, and they've got their weekly president meeting, council presidents, where they talk, and they meet with the chair and the vice chair, is very important. But making sure that how that rolls up into the full evaluation is very important. And we've, as you've known through the years, we've changed it, I think, 3 times since you and I have been here on the presidential evaluation as to how we actually do the full 360 outside evaluation. So it is taking a look, worth taking a look at, but it is clearly defining under the charge of this committee what the chancellor's responsibilities are, A, in the annual evaluation, and B, in rolling into that used to be a 3-year, now 4-year evaluation. But I think it was President Zaragoza who said it best, but I'm not sure. But I mean, we evaluate everybody every day, and it's you should not be waiting for an annual evaluation or a 3-4 year evaluation. You should be getting feedback from your campus, from your community, from your presidents. And in the specific role of chancellor, it's your cabinet and the presidents. What am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? How do we advance it forward? And it's kind of been an in and out situation, but I think, you know, like Robert is, we used to have him as a more formal member of the cabinet. And that made the communication between the cabinet members and the presidents and the chancellor and the board very clear. And that kind of fell apart. That may be something we want to consider going forward, is making that a formal part of it. The other is, I mean, we can ask the legislature. I'm a bit of a pessimist. I think it's like merit pay. We can ask them to let us close meetings for presidential evaluations. I don't think they're going to. So I think if we can kind of structure the annual evaluations with the chancellor and the presidents so that when we hit the 3-4 year evaluation that is the public meeting, that no one's really surprised and it's not something that jumps out at anybody, but I really don't expect them to close it back up for us. And with that, thank you.
Thank you, Regent Geddes. I'm going to go to Chair McAdoo, and then we'll go to Regent Carter.
I just wanted to agree with Regent Geddes' comment about our Chief of Staff and Special Counsel being on the Chancellor's Cabinet. I've served as a regent where that happened, and I've served as a regent and the chair where that did not happen. And I can see the value in that happening because the Chief of Staff and General Counsel maybe can intervene in some of the, I guess I'll say attorney-client privilege with a regent sharing that where I as the chair could not. I think it's definitely a good thing to look at when we're looking at the overall picture of what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Carter.
I have some relatively granular kind of feedback. A minor correction to Geddes, we have 11 employees. Joe Sunbury also reports to the board. But if you look at the description, Chancellor of the Board shall be evaluated annually by the Chair of the Board. That needs to be expanded to something else. It needs to be reworded to where it's not just in one person's hands. Under Section E, duties of the Chancellor prescribed by the Board of Regents and include but are not limited to the following, And it says the chancellor may delegate. I think we need to close the may delegate and kind of reword that to be something more specific. Under number three, to provide or prepare in collaboration with committee chairs. I can't think of a single meeting where I've ever met with the chancellor on a committee that I've been the chair of, unless I approached the chancellor. So either leave it in there or take it out to reflect the reality. Number eight, to serve as the contracting officer. This is one of my not necessarily pet peeves, but I think we have all these contracts that come into the system. They come into our legal department. They, you know, for lack of a better word, bottleneck. And I'm not sure at some point, like it seems like we have competent counsel at our institutions. Like we need to figure out what that threshold is so that they're not overwhelmed by so many contracts having to come to the board specifically to be signed by the chancellor. Number nine, to provide for internal audits and assist the Board of Regents in the appointment of an independent auditor. I've been here for, two searches for independent auditors. I don't recall any chancellor involvement in there, so that's another case of just maybe that involvement happened outside with the chief finance officer, but me as the audit chair, I haven't had that contact. To recommend appointment of special counsel, I'm not sure if that's necessarily should be in there. I think that might fall to the chief chief general counsel. To evaluate the annual performance for each president and member of the institutions according with procedures, that's a policy that needs to be revised, and I think that's being worked on. Number 14, discipline for cause. I'm almost done. So discipline for cause up to termination by the chancellor. And then at the bottom there, it has a little caveat. Any disciplinary action shall only be taken in consultation with the chair of the board. I think we just need to rethink how that whole thing kind of reads. It reads like they can do it, and then it reads that they can't do it at the end. So I think, you know, when it says both of those things, you could have a legal counsel say it goes one way one time and one way the other time. So I think you just need to choose. They either can or they can't. You know, they can't do it. And then I think I'll end there. I think that's a good place to end for right now. Thanks.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Any other regents? Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard from a couple of the presidents about the dual reporting structure where the presidents come to the board. I think that needs to be somewhere in there so that it's clear that that relationship is expected.
Thank you. Okay. And we can always bring ideas forward at our next meeting, which is, again, going to be information only. I'm going to go to new business. Any new business as it regards to the ad hoc committee? Seeing none, I'm going to ask for public comment. Any public comment in ELCO?
There is no public comment in ELCO.
Any public comment in Reno?
Kent Irvin of the Faculty Alliance, thank you. I just wanted to not respond, but comment on a couple of things that came up and came to mind. Right now, yes, there are no qualifications for being regent other than being a resident of the district and, I suppose, a voting age. But what can happen is more robust training for regents because we have representatives of constituents who come to the board who don't necessarily start out with much knowledge of higher education or the system. And so how can that be done through the open meeting law? You could require separate trainings, but many boards in Nevada with the open meeting law have education sessions, workshops, retreats. Yes, they have to be public, but that doesn't mean you can't have that kind of more informal meeting open to the public, but on topics of interest or need, and then that helps build relationships. So I'm aware of the PERS board that before every monthly meeting has an education session where that's separate from the business meeting, and the Nevada Deferred Compensation Committee that has an annual all-day strategic planning workshop. It can have action items too, but it's a public meeting, but it's mostly informational and gathering information, doing some of the required trainings and those sorts of things. So I think there are things that you could do that were within the open meeting law, and I agree with the idea that it might be hard to get a change of the open meeting law legislatively for evaluations. I don't necessarily disagree that evaluations can be more effective done confidentially, but I think somehow we have to work with what we have. And then what I heard from Wuchi, which I appreciate, is that big structural changes can be counterproductive, and let's fix things that are broken, but not try to change the whole system. I think that would be a good goal to have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any public comment here in Las Vegas? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everybody.